Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Jessica from Greenlight, and we are thrilled to host tonight's event with Charles Yu presenting his National Book Award-winning novel, Interior Chinatown. He's going to be talking tonight with Charlie Jane Anders, so you are in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Charles and Charlie Jane and the team at Vintage Contemporaries for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces right now, our community of authors and readers is still here, and we're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. We are recording tonight's event, so look for video or audio versions on our social media channels later on. And very importantly, tonight's featured book, Interior Chinatown, as well as other books by Charles and Charlie Jane, are available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person at our bookstore locations, 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. every day of the week, and you can purchase those books and many others on site, or order online at greenlightbookstore.com for pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. I'll drop the buy link in the chat in a moment. So if you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Okay, some introductions. Our interviewer tonight is Charlie Jane Anders. She's the author previously of The City in the Middle of the Night and All the Birds in the Sky, and of the forthcoming Victories Greater Than Death, the first book in a new young adult trilogy. Her fiction and journalism have appeared in the New York Times, The Washington Post, McSweeney's, Tin House, and many other places. Her TED Talk, Go Ahead, Dream About the Future, got 700,000 views in its first week, and she co-hosts the podcast Our Opinions Are Correct with Annalee Newitz. She's going to be speaking tonight with our featured author, Charles Yu. He's the author previously of three books, including the novel How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, which was a New York Times notable book and a Time Magazine Best Book of the Year. He received the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award and was nominated for two Writers Guild of America Awards for his work on the HBO series Westworld. He's also written for shows on FX, AMC, and HBO. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Wall Street Journal, among other publications. His most recent book, Interior Chinatown, which was just published in paperback, is a deeply personal novel about race, pop culture, immigration, assimilation, and escaping the roles we're forced to play. This infinitely inventive story is Yu's most moving, daring, and masterful novel yet, and we are as thrilled as his many other fans that it won the 2020 National Book Award for Fiction 2 weeks ago. Charles is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then he's going to be talking with Charlie Jane and then with all of you. So please take it away, Charles.
Thanks, Jessica. Thanks for that great introduction. And thank you, everyone, for being here. I'm really excited. Thanks to Greenlight Bookstore. And yes, the good people at Vintage and Pantheon. And of course, to Charlie Jane Anders, who I'm so excited to talk to. I of course, want to be here and do this and read. But it's also a chance to hang out with Charlie Jane, who we'll get into it, but who I haven't seen since early February. In San Francisco at Writers with Drinks. But first, I'll read a little bit from Interior Chinatown. Interior Golden Palace. Ever since you were a boy, you've dreamt of being Kung Fu Guy. You are not Kung Fu Guy. You're currently background Oriental male, but you've been practicing. Maybe tomorrow will be the day. Interior Golden Palace. Ever since you were a boy, you've dreamt of being Kung Fu Guy. You are not Kung Fu Guy. You are currently Oriental Guy making a weird face, but you've been practicing. Maybe tomorrow will be the day. Take what you can get. Try to build a life at the margin, made from bit parts. Willis Wu, Asian actor. Skills: Kung Fu, moderate proficiency. Fluent in accented English. able to do face of great shame on command. Resume, disgraced son, delivery guy, silent henchman, guy who runs in and gets kicked in the face, striving immigrant, generic Asian man. Your mother has played, in no particular order, pretty oriental flower, Asiatic seductress, young dragon lady, slightly less young dragon lady, restaurant hostess, beautiful maiden number one, dead beautiful maiden number one, old Asian woman. Your father has been, at various times, twin dragon, wizened Chinaman, guy in a soiled t-shirt, inscrutable grocery owner, in a soiled t-shirt, egg roll cook, young Asian man, Sifu, the mysterious kung fu master, old Asian man. Interior Golden Palace, morning. In the world of black and white, everyone starts out as generic Asian man. Everyone who looks like you, anyway. Unless you're a woman, in which case you start out as pretty Asian woman. You all work at Golden Palace, formerly Jade Palace, formerly Palace of Good Fortune. There's an aquarium in the front and cloudy tanks of rock crabs and 2-pound lobsters crawling over each other in the back. Laminated menus offer the lunch special, which comes with a bowl of fluffy white rice and choice of soup, egg drop or hot and sour. A neon Qingdao sign blinks and buzzes behind the bar in the dimly lit space, a dropped ceiling room with lacquered ornate woodwork or some imitation thereof, everything simmering in a warm, seedy red glow, thrown off by the dollar store paper lanterns festooned above, many of them darkened by dead moths, the paper yellowing, ripped, curling in on itself. You wear the uniform, white shirt, black pants, black slipper-like shoes that have no traction whatsoever. Your haircut is not good, to say the least. Black and white always look good. A lot of it has to do with the light. They're the heroes. They get hero lighting designed to hit their faces just right. Designed to hit white's face just right, anyway. Someday you want the light to hit your face like that. To look like the hero. Or for a moment to actually be the hero. Thank you. Yay. Thanks.
It's so weird that we don't, you know, we don't get to like all applaud and like, you know, I feel like everybody should like just make right type clap in the chat or something. But, you know, it's, this is something I miss. Like you mentioning Writers for Drakes, which, you know, you were at, I guess, back in February. Yeah. You know, I miss that kind of live venue feeling. Obviously it's lovely to be here with you know everybody and to see you, and you know it's, this is obviously fantastic. But anyway, so that was amazing and congrats on the National Book Award. And I'm just like, you know, I love Interior Chinatown so much. I think it's like, you know, it's, I think it's my favorite thing that you've written, which is actually saying a lot. And you know, I just was wondering if you could talk us through like how it came to be. I read an interview where you said that basically, because it was like 10 years between your previous novel and this one. And I read an interview where you said that you kind of were stuck until the 2016 election, and then that kind of shook something loose. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about like how that happened and what it was that kind of gave you the impetus to write this book.
Yeah. Thanks, Charlie Jane. I really appreciate that. And I appreciated your Goodreads review of my book, which like honestly has got one of the things that got me through publishing a book this year. Because for a lot of the year I would just, you know, sit at home and look at Goodreads.
Oh no, don't do that. No.
But yours was always at the top, you know, and it was like, and that was a good way to sort of come back to it. So I appreciate that a lot. As I did your, I don't know, people, you know you probably from, you know, Hugo and Nebula award-winning fiction. But if you haven't been there and you are ever able to get to San Francisco after, on the other side of the pandemic, Charlie Jane's, I guess I'd call it patter or interstitial commentary during this series that she's run for years, right, at Writers with Drinks, is incredible. Like, somebody should record it and publish it, or I don't know what it should be, but it's got to live on in some form. It's like this free flowing stream of consciousness, monologue, I guess what it is. But to answer your question, I think the election of Donald J. Trump as the president really did, it was both, you know, like for many people, I think it was a shock, and it also made me take a look at my writing and say, what am I doing kind of messing around with this? You know, do I have something to say or not? And so I had been sitting with this manuscript for a long time and trying different versions of it and really failing at it. And it was a story about immigrants, you know, it's a story inspired by a lot of things about my parents' lives, about becoming a dad and a husband and, you know, being an American. And I think that the election really gave it a new urgency. You know, it's like, this is a story I want to tell. I want to talk about what it means to try to feel like an American and never quite feel like one, you know, for generations before me, but also for me, and what that might mean for, you know, young people now. So
it was the story that you had been wanting to tell before 2016, but the 2016 election just gave you a different way of telling it, or made it more urgent, or made it more kind of gave you a different sense of how and why to tell it, kind of? Is that right?
I think it shook loose something in my subconscious. I think that's right. It made it more, it felt like I should, I guess, to be more specific, I had tried versions of it that were kind of a fuzzy, magical realism about immigrants coming to a strange land. And I didn't know what I was doing with it. You know, I just thought, this is a story about how, you know, this is a story about assimilation and about trying to learn the rules of a new place. And I was trying to equate something about some kind of low-level magic with America. And I just didn't, as you can probably tell, I had no idea what I was doing with it. And so I think sometime in early 2017, this version of the book started to just sort of pop into my head. I think it was a confluence of two things. One was I wanted to write about it in a more direct way. So I was searching for a way to say, what's the voice? You know, what am I looking for here? And it came to me in the form of Willis Wu's, you know, interior monologue. It's like, here's a person who we don't, you know, give a lot of subjectivity often, which is the background Asian dude who, you know, who's there to either get beat up or to deliver food. How do I give a voice to that character? So it was both kind of a new entryway, you know, a new entry point into the story. And then I think the other thing that happened around the same time is I've been working in TV for a couple of years at that point, and that framework must have sort of seeped in to my head enough that I felt like, oh, try this. And so it was sort of like that. And you're working in TV as well, or you have been for a few years as well. So I don't know how you feel about how that affects your fiction or not, but I think there was something going on there, and it took a couple of years to marinate.
Yeah, so interesting. And the thing that you mentioned about like Writers with Drinks, where like kind of what I'm doing with Writers with Drinks is kind of metafiction in a way. It's like I make up weird fictional bios for the authors, including yourself. And so, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was metafiction and like the thing of like blending the real and the kind of surreal and like having, you know, characters who kind of exist in this liminal space where they're kind of aware of their own, almost aware of their own fictionality, but also have an independent existence. You know, how do you feel like your attitudes to metafiction has changed over the course of your career as a writer? And how do you think metafiction is different now than in like the heyday of postmodern literature, like say in the 90s with like Don DeLillo and everybody? Those are two huge questions. So you can kind of take your pick.
Yeah. I'm going to definitely duck the second one because that
okay.
qualified to answer that. Other than I read Don DeLillo, you know, first as an undergrad at Berkeley, and you know, fell in love with White Noise and you know Americana and it. I think over the course of you know I don't know how long a couple decades of trying to write fiction. I've always, I'm just drawn to the meta, and, you know, for better or worse. I don't know that I will ever fully get away from it. I think there's something about, I probably watched too many like cartoons that broke the fourth wall when I was a kid. And that's just what is the inventory of my, you know, impoverished imagination. I'm, you know, very self-conscious person, you know, I can't do, I think the thing that I've gotten more comfortable with over time is just owning that and just saying, yeah, but, you know, I'm playing with form and that's not, and playing with devices that, you know, often get me into the realm of metafiction or something that kind of flirts with, you know, the characters or the story, you know, drawing attention to the sort of rules or boundaries of the world, you know, the artificiality of certain constructs. I think I thought at first that I would try to get away from that. I think every once in a while I forget that I'm not like a writer, you know, like a guy who can just sit down and like write prose, and you know, like I have to have a weird thing that's fun about it, you know what I mean, and then I know how to like then I get excited. But if I sit down, I'm like, I'm gonna write something serious and naturalistic and it is like looks like sentences on a page, I just bore myself. And so that stuff for me just never sustains because I can't even keep my own attention. So that's basically part of, you know, why this book took so long is I thought for a long time, this is a serious book. It's a serious, heavy book. And I just don't really know how to do that. So, and I do wonder, the only thing I feel like I would say about the second part of your question is I do wonder like if there's a kind of collective learning curve with metafiction, you know, and maybe TV plays into some of that, or maybe comics or just fiction in general. But it's like, you know, people are really, really good at dissecting stories and knowing, you know, sort of the tropes and conventions of what they're of the space that someone's playing in. And I think in some ways that makes it really hard to try to write something that's going to surprise people because readers are so good at understanding what you're trying to do. But that can also be super helpful, you know, because the act of reading and writing, you know, in the sense that it's always a collaboration, you can use the expertise of the audience to do some of the world building for you, if that makes sense. And I'm a very lazy person, so that's very helpful. I'm just like, you know what I'm trying to do, just fill in the blanks.
Nothing about your work or especially Interior Chinatown strikes me as lazy, although I do think it's interesting that like we do live in an era where people are more kind of genre savvy and more kind of like trope savvy than ever before, and there are like whole internet parts of the internet that are just cataloging tropes, right? And like here's all the places this trope appears across all media, and it is this weird thing of like people are like obsessively like aware of like when you're using a trope. It is super interesting. You know, the thing you said before about it, like you wanted to write a serious magical realist book, and then you kind of after the election you kind of realized that you wanted to do this something that was a little bit more meta and a little bit more satirical, you know, how is it? Like, I feel like there's this thing that people say now about like how satire is impossible in 2020 in the Trump era, and that, you know, but at the same time, we've gotten things like Sorry to Bother You. We've gotten like so much like incredibly intense, like just powerful, weird, surreal satire. And I would put your book in that same camp. Do you think that there's something about this era that we've been living through that actually is best addressed through like surrealism and kind of making, you know, and a kind of tongue-in-cheek sensibility?
That's a really cool way to frame it. I feel like that's something that that's like the basis for a good think piece essay that I hope you write. Something that might have been published on io9 back in the day, or maybe in you know, in the Atlantic or something. But it is interesting that I'm not probably equipped to actually figure out why that is, but I think there's a lot to what you're saying in that if there's a form of satire where it was let's do an exaggeration of reality, there was that, you know, we stretched that to the limit and then broke it, right? We passed whatever the elasticity limit of that was, and so it kind of requires starting from a place that isn't realism, you know, to really get to capture the weirdness of, you know, the time we're living in, you know, especially the last 4 years. I think I might just have restated your question, but yeah.
No, not at all. That, I mean, you know, I think it's something that I've thought about a lot, especially with like the, you know, the utility of satire, but also, yeah, the extent to which playing around with story and with the format of story is kind of a response to, you know, a world in which people pretend to believe one thing and then pretend to believe the opposite thing like a week later as a matter of like just normal life. Like this is just regularly, and people will say something and be like, I never said that. And, you know, it's that sort of thing. It's like a very weird time to think about narrative. And like, so, when I was listening to you read a little while ago, you know, it really struck me how, like, and this is something that really permeates every page of Interior Chinatown, the mechanics of making a TV show are part of the DNA of this book. And, you know, Black and White feels like a show that you could actually watch or maybe have watched. You know, how much work did you do? Like, first of all, how much did your experience working in TV inform this book? Have you spent a lot of time on set, like, in TV, or have you mostly been in the writer's room? How are those two things part of what informed this book? And also, I guess, as I'm giving you grab bag questions, I apologize, that's just where I'm at right now, but also how deep into like figuring out like exactly how this TV show works and, you know, the mechanics of it did you go in writing this, like Black and White, the show?
I wrote a whole season of Black and White and shot it on my iPhone. No, That would be cool though. I have spent a little bit of time on set, not a ton of it. You know, I've been in a few rooms now and had the good luck of, you know, working for showrunners that let, you know, a total, you know, beginner like me on the set and, you know, and really gain that experience. I don't know if you've had, you know, that experience in the rooms you've been.
But I was supposed to, you know. But if the pandemic hadn't happened, I would have spent like the entire month of June on set this past June, but you know, it didn't happen.
Next time, soon.
Yeah.
I hope. I found it really valuable for, you know, to see the process, to see how the writing fits in with it. But also you just get to see all these, you know, people do their craft and their art. And so you know, on set and from lighting to, you know, to camera, to sound and obviously the actors and director, but you really get to see how it's all put together. And it's also just a huge amount of fuel for the imagination. You know, it's this artificial world with a lot of like free food. You know, it's just like, I can't believe it's a job, really. I mean, there are downsides to it. It's really long, and there are stretches where you're, you know, under pressure, or people are under pressure. But as the writer, I think it's often like, I just felt like a tourist on set who got to observe this really cool environment and learn how to be a better writer for the screen, you know, in some ways, like to see what works and what doesn't work. You know, a lot of times I'd write a line, and then when I actually realized, oh, a human being has to say this line, I'd cringe at myself, like, oh, now, okay, don't, you know. Or, you know, when you write action lines and you think, oh, that's a cool idea, but it is that, it's an idea, but somebody has to translate that into like tangible production, you know, design, or into blocking or something. So
it has to be producible.
It has to be producible. Yeah. I know there are exceptions. If you, I don't know, Darren Aronofsky or somebody like, I mean, or, you know, any number of like people who are sort of, I haven't had, you know, worked on that kind of thing, but like in TV, even on something as like Westworld or Legion, it's like, ultimately they're going to have to do something on a budget, on a schedule. So as visionary as you want to try to be, there will be constraints at some point, you know? And so that's all interesting. I think that it also informed the book in some ways, because it showed me how you can get to a place, even with good intentions, how you can get to a place where, you know, things get simplified and reduced. And I think that was, I felt more confident in writing something that could capture that without simply, you know, painting with a sort of broad brush, like, oh, TV sort of flattens and stereotypes everybody, knowing that, no, despite best intentions, you can definitely still end up in a situation where, you know, you have an unfortunate generalization or you have stereotypes. So I think that's how that process sort of informed it. I think, you know, I think in the writer's room, it's a totally different thing, but yeah, I've droned on long enough about this. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore.
No, but I mean, I apologize if this is a sensitive question, but have you usually been the only Asian American in the writer's room in the rooms that you've been in? And what's that been like, if so?
I have, usually, you know, with one exception, I have. And it's not something you think about, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and then you do. You know, it's my experience in general. It's like just going through life, and then sometimes going, oh yeah, you know, I'm Asian, and I'm the only one here. I'm sort of used to it from being a lawyer too. You know, there are plenty of times where I wasn't, but there are also plenty of times, especially earlier in my career, when I was the only person of color in the room even. So I think it's good fuel for being a writer, you know, it's sort of have just never quite feel like you're totally comfortable in your skin, or at least that's my default mode. But yeah, it's something that I've been conscious of at times, and then other times felt like I forget.
So, you know, do you feel like, you know, in the time since you started working on Interior Chinatown, do you feel like representation of Asians in Hollywood has gotten a little bit better with, like, I don't know, shows like Warrior and movies like The Farewell? And, you know, do you think that there's been some improvement along those lines, or do you feel like it's, you know, how do you feel about the last few years of Asian American representation, I guess, in Hollywood?
I mean, I feel good about it in the sense that, yeah, that it's, you know, you used to be able to count on one hand, or just know, oh yeah, there's an Asian thing on right now. Let's see how long we get to have this before it goes away. And now I think there's probably, you know, between actors who are sort of regulars, you know, or shows that, like you're, you know, mentioning Warrior or movies like The Farewell, there are enough where you know, people will tell me about something and I won't even know about it. And that's a great place to be just in terms of sheer numbers, you know? But I think even more than just quantitatively, I think it's encouraging that different kinds of stories are being told, you know, and different points of view are getting access to the means of production. I think that's, you know, like anything, it takes time and it doesn't always go straight ahead in a forward progress, but it's, to me, I'm encouraged.
Yay. So just a reminder to the audience, we're going to have a Q&A. We'll probably start doing audience questions in like maybe 10 minutes. I got a couple more questions I wanted to ask, but if you want to click the little double speech balloon and just, you know, write down your questions, hopefully we'll get a chance to ask a few of them. So far there's one I see in there. So, you know, if you have any things that you've always wanted to know, hopefully relevant to this book and, you know, not just, you know, not just asking for, I don't know, weird statistical facts about, like, you know, the metropolitan statistical area of Indianapolis or whatever, or I don't know. But anyway, I spent some time this afternoon reading some of the interviews that you've done about this book. And so I was thinking about some of the stuff that you said in those interviews. And one of the things that came to mind that was really interesting to me is this whole question of like what it means to be the protagonist of your own story versus being the narrator of your own story. And like I read one interview where you were talking about the fact that like so much of this book is kind of goes in and out of second person, in addition to these scripts, these like TV scripts, which are also a very rigid format. And like, so Willis Wu, a lot of the time doesn't get to narrate his own story. He gets narrated, and you know, that versus the thing of him getting to be the hero versus like a background player. I was wondering if you could talk about those two things and how they intersect in this book and just in general.
Yeah. Thanks. The book is in second person, which was a hard choice to make because, you know, personally, if I start reading a book and it's second person, I'm already thinking, oh, okay. You know, like it's definitely unusual. Not that I enjoyed plenty of them, but I just thought, is this going to turn off some segment of readers already right from the get-go who may not like this? But it ultimately had to be in that. I actually tried to write it in first and third, and it became a form of procrastination where I would just spend a whole morning changing it from first person to third person, and then the next day changing it back. Really good use of time. But when I finally realized, oh, second person does these things for me, it really helped, which was it gave the flexibility, you know, I think that you're talking about in terms of Willis is being narrated to, you know, at times. The you is some kind of unseen authorial, you know, sort of voice that's telling Willis what the story is and how Willis is supposed to act within the story. You know, follow the script, follow your stage directions. And then at times, you know, it shades into something else, which is an interior dialogue or monologue that Willis is having, where he's essentially talking to himself. And so I found that to be the right kind of fluidity that I was looking for, in terms of sometimes he feels like he's got agency and sometimes he feels like he doesn't. And hopefully in the book, there's a sort of, it feels like there is a, it makes sense at moments when he does and doesn't. But yeah, I think in terms of being a protagonist, the book is really about, you know, people who don't get to have the story be about them, you know, for once get to have the story be about them. Willis, but also many of the other characters, you know, Willis's parents. And then even beyond that, I think it looks at people who are the sort of ostensible stars of the show. And even they kind of are circumscribed by their roles. You know, I mean, they're supposed to be attractive or dashing or exciting. And, you know, I think all of these sort of roles are, you know, not giving full subjectivity or dimension to, you know, who they are as people. So I was really just looking for a way to explore that. And in this kind of construct of, oh, they're living in this kind of law and order type universe, but they've got, you know, full consciousness, so that they're not, they don't know how to break out of the sort of the extremely sort of rigid template that they're stuck in.
Yeah, and actually part of what I love about, one of the many things I love about Interior Chinatown is how it does kind of open out as the book goes on, and Willis Wu becomes more of like, feels more like he gets layers as a character as the book goes on. Like that's one of the things I really love, and the fact that, you know, he starts out as kind of, in a way, like he starts out as kind of a representation of something, I feel like, and but as very quickly he starts becoming a more complex character in his own right. One of the actually a really kind of basic dumb question, but why a police procedural? Why is Black and White, like, you know, in your own work, you haven't, in your own TV work, you haven't written for that kind of show. Did you think about making it like a sci-fi show or a, you know, something else? Or what made you decide to do like a Law and Order type show?
Yeah. I watched a lot of SVU when my kids were babies, because I would just have to hold them until they fell asleep. And there's always Law and Order on, you know, always. And so I just absorbed a great deal of it. I think it fit with, you know, the idea is that Interior Chinatown is many things, I hope. But one thing it is the setting for the very special episode, you know, the ethnic subculture episode. I think less common now, but still not, you see it, but I think 10, 20, 30 years ago, you saw it a lot more of, oh, here's the one time in a season where we're going to go to Chinatown, you know, and do an episode there about, I don't know, human trafficking or about some other horrible thing that's happening in this ethnic subculture. And so it felt like the most easily recognizable kind of pattern that a lot of people would already be familiar with. And they would also probably understand, I would hope, you know, that very special episode I'm talking about, you know, where you get to go and you're like, oh, there's the, look, they're all the background, you know, Asian extras. And so, I just hoped, you know, kind of circling back to what we talked about at the beginning, I hope to leverage the familiarity with that trope.
Right. So we should probably take some audience questions. We've got like a bunch now. I'm just going to start at the bottom. Michelle Cohen asks, wondering if you could talk about the meaning of interior, the word interior, throughout the book and the chapter titles.
Sure. Thanks, Michelle. I think I was sort of edging up to it just in that last one. Interior is a bit of doing a little double work there. You know, it is the slug line for scripts, you know, for an interior setting. So it works on that level. But I think this book in some ways is a mental, takes place in kind of an intersection of a mental place and a physical place. You know, there is a mental ghetto that Willis lives in, where he's on some level put himself there, but also been put there by external forces that he feels trapped in. He feels trapped in this conception of who he is. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, the book is a progression from interior to exterior, you know. And so that, you know, the chapter titles also to me felt like that as well, in that he's sort of progressing through from generic Asian man, you know, to becoming a recurring character, ethnic recurring, to, you know, eventually getting what he thinks he wants and then finding out it's more complicated than he thought.
So Marisa wants to know, what is your working relationship like with your editor? How vital for you is the role of your editor?
It's vital. Tim O'Connell at Knopf this book is published by Pantheon, which is kind of in the same family. And so, but Tim has been my editor for more than 10 years now. We worked on How to Live Safely together. And, you know, he acquired that book when it was just like a really kind of confusing set of ideas about time travel. And he helped me shape it. And, you know, without even having any kind of clue as to whether or not it could become a book, he was just sort of, and so we struggled with this for a long time together. But I think we had had such a deep trust. I trust him a lot anyway. And then at some point in the process, his then assistant, now she's been promoted to an editor, Anna Kaufman, also came on. So I had two editors, and so I had two really good brains helping me find my way out of the woods. So it was great. And my agent, Julie Bearer, is also actually secretly a great editor. So I kind of had three editors, which, as you can imagine, is hard because three sets of notes is also not fun to deal with at times, but it was really valuable to have all three of them.
Yeah, I mean, I always feel like the more feedback I can get, the better, especially since, you know, the longer I do this for, the less, the faster the kind of pipeline from like me writing something to wanting, having to turn it in gets to be. So I don't know. I don't have as much time to show it to like 20 people and like get, I don't know. I'm actually in the same boat with like having my editor's former assistant is now an editor. And so I have actually two editors who weigh in, and sometimes my UK editor will also send me some notes, and I'm just like, more, give me more notes. I need to know where it's broken before Goodreads tells me. Anyway, so Monica has a question that, you know, boils down to basically being about imposter syndrome. I feel like it's, how do you overcome the hurdle of feeling like your story might not be worthy or deserve to be told and read? What advice do you give to writers who are afraid their voice is unimportant, doesn't stand out enough, or who can't help feeling narcissistic practicing the art of writing and pursuing publishing? Basically, how do you deal with imposter syndrome?
Oh, I don't know. If anyone has any, if anyone knows the answer, please put it in the chat, because I've been doing this for, you know, 20 years, and it doesn't, you know, it just takes on new forms, but it's, I still think I wake up, you know, in the middle of the night just thinking, oh, you know, like, what did I say on that Zoom interview? you know, cringing at sort of things I've said or written. And then during, in the actual process, as I think Monica's hinting at, it's, how do I justify the time and the effort that I'm spending on this? You know, why would anyone want this? This is so idiosyncratic or personal, or not just that, you know, does this matter? Will someone care about this? I don't know. I guess the only thing that I could offer in the way of learning over the last, you know, however many years of trying to do this, is that I've gotten more comfortable with my own voice, you know, for all of its imperfections. And it's not, I've used different analogies, but I guess another way to think about it is, I'm not an opera singer, you know, like I don't play in the Philharmonic. I don't play cello or violin. You know, I play this weird thing that I made out of stuff from my garage, and nobody else plays this instrument. So maybe that's kind of an answer. I sort of snuck up on an answer there. Is if you convince yourself that the instrument you play makes a sound that only you can make, then maybe that'll make you think it's worth it, because you're not trying to be an imposter. You're not trying to impersonate anyone else. You're just doing your own weird thing.
I love that answer. I'm going to actually quote that answer. That's amazing. That answer is perfect.
Thanks.
I love the weird instrument you made out of stuff from your garage too. That's like such a great image. It's going to stick in my mind. Rebecca wants to know from both of us what 2021 books are on our to read list. And I have to think about that one, because I've gotten to the point now where I don't know which year books are coming out in. because I get like a lot of advanced copies, but I also get a lot of books that came out like a year or two ago, and I'm just like, they're all mixed together in a giant pile. But what's your answer for books that come out in 2021?
I have two. I hear there's a Charlie Jane Anders book coming out. That's exciting. When is it coming out?
It comes out in April. This is the cover behind me. It's called Victory is Greater Than Death. It's my first young adult novel.
Should I read it? I have a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. Should I read it with them or should I read it just for myself?
I would hope that they would be able to dig it. Like, I think YA is supposed to be like 12 and up, basically. So if your 11-year-old is a little precocious, fingers crossed, if they're okay with a little bit of, there's a little bit of queerness, there's a tiny bit of sex, but you know, anyway, it's, but what other books coming out in 2021 are you excited about?
I don't know the title yet, but I know that Anna North has a book, and she wrote a book a few years ago, America Pacifica, which was a great novel. And so I think she's got one coming out, so I'm excited about that.
I mean, there are some, I hate to be all like sequels, but there are some sequels coming out in 2021 that I'm really excited about. Like my friend Maggie Takuda Hall has the sequel to her novel, The Mermaid, the Witch, and the Sea, coming out in 2021. I think the sequel to Legend Born by Tracy Dion is coming out in 2021. The sequel to Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse. And also the sequel to N.K. Jemisin's The City We Became. So there's a bunch of books that I've read recently where I'm going to hunt down those sequels because I love those books so much. Also, a book that I read recently that I was asked to blurb, which comes out in 2021, is a book of short stories by Isabel Yap called YAP, called Never Have I Ever. And those stories are amazing. I mean, her stuff is kind of magical realism and is very weird and is beautiful. And that book is published by Small Beer Press, which is the publishing company run by Kelly Link and Gavin Grant. And so it's kind of their sensibility of like kind of slightly weird, surreal, but like just beautiful writing. So Never Have I Ever by Isabel Yap is a book that I've already read that comes out in 2021, which I highly recommend. I feel like there's a few other books that I've read recently that come out in 2021, but my brain is just, it's all a giant pile of mush, unfortunately, in my brain. So Julie wants to know how autobiographical is Interior Chinatown, and where did you grow up, and what's, you know, does this sort of relationship to Chinatown as a place, like, does that resonate with you in your own life, kind of?
It is 34% autobiographical and 66%. It is, the core of a lot of the relationships comes from life. My parents are immigrants from Taiwan, and a lot of the stories they told me about what it was like for them when they first came here, trying to build a family and careers, that all is based, you know, with, there's plenty of sort of foundation for that in their lives. Becoming a dad and a husband, you know, during the course of this book, my kids went from toddlers to like middle schoolers. That's how long it took to write. But that informed a lot of it too. So I think emotionally autobiographical in a lot of ways, factually not super autobiographical. I grew up in Southern California and did not spend time, you know, in Chinatown, especially not in like Chinatown. I mean, Southern California has Monterey Park and has San Gabriel, and we would obviously go there to eat and to do other things. But it's not Chinatown in the sense of like Oakland's or San Francisco's or New York's. So I had to do some research. You know, I spent a little bit of time in Oakland Chinatown when I was at Berkeley, but really it's more of a amalgam of research and a very TV version of Chinatown. You know, the imagination projection of Chinatown.
Right. So the one more question that we have in the Q&A is from Pete, who wants to know, you know, the section of the book with the old Asian man singing karaoke, you know, blew Pete away. It was poetry and he could see it standing alone, but that it came back at the end and it was perfect. And was there any special inspiration which behind that part of the book, behind that story?
Yeah. Thanks, Pete. There was, I mean, I've seen an old Taiwanese man like completely kill it, that song, like just, you know, sing it better than like, you know, I would have thought possible. And so I've also seen some not sing it so well, to be honest, but I think it's just a song that came up a couple of times. I remember as a kid just like, oh, why, you know, why that? I remember my dad, you know, would like, if John Denver were on the radio or something, would, you know, would know the lyrics or would, and so, or like he's a big fan of Nat King Cole. And I really had to have a bit in there about what it's like to be a kid, think of your dad as a, you know, as an immigrant, a foreigner to this country, and then realize, oh, my parents know a lot more about this place than I do because they've been here longer. So, yeah. And then I brought it back at the end, partly because, you know, I like things that rhyme and I felt like it had to. Tim, my editor, actually at one point was like, you have it three times. That's too many. I guess I fell in love with that scene. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Probably three times of karaoke is too much. So we cut one out.
Yeah, I'm always like, it's a motif. Like if people are like, why does this just happen over and over again? I'm like, it's a motif. Like if it happens twice, it's just a coincidence. But if it happens three or four times, then it's a motif and you can just get away with it. Like, I'm always just like, the more I run something into the ground, the more it looks intentional rather than me just like repeating myself. I don't know, but it's tricky. Did you read the book Useful Phrases for Immigrants by Mei Li Chai? That was like a book that came out a couple. I love that book so much. Okay. She's local. She's here in San Francisco. Yeah. And, you know, she teaches at SF State.
Writers with Drinks.
She was at Writers with Drinks. Yeah. Wait, were you at Writers with Drinks together? Or
no, she came with her colleague. I think it was her colleague at San Francisco State that was reading that night. Now, of course, I can't remember her name.
Oh, man.
One of the other readers that night. That's terrible.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah. Anyway, so we're out of audience questions, but I have one more question from my list that I had written down before the event that I'm excited to ask. And it's sort of about like, basically, how much work do you think you should ask the reader to do as an author? And like, do you worry about asking the reader to do too much work, or do you conversely worry about not asking the reader to do enough work? Like, do you think that readers like to do a lot of work? And do you think that that's part of the pleasure of reading?
That's such
in terms of like, interesting. Yeah, sorry, to just throwing you a giant, huge question at the last like 3 minutes.
No, I love it. I know as a reader, there's a sweet spot, I think. Like, I don't know. I was not a good econ student, but like two curves intersect and there's some intersection point where the optimal amount of work is, you know, maybe it varies for every reader. For me, it's like, the pleasure point where you're like, I'm doing just enough to feel like I'm exerting my muscles a little bit, but not so much that I'm actually, you know, out of breath. And I think that it's that's what I enjoy as a reader. Usually, I don't mind when something is super difficult. It's just that's not always going to be my first thing I reach for if I'm super tired or if I only have 20 minutes to read. You know, there's certain things that you can just pick up and just fall into them for a little bit. So I think as a writer, I would love that. I don't think I often hit that for whatever reason. I think I often err on the side of just, you know, here's a whole bunch of things you've never seen, deal with it, you know, like here's a book in screenplay format in second person that is sometimes written in the margin. I don't know. So I'm a total hypocrite, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I personally feel like if a book isn't asking that much of me, I get bored. Like if it's like, I like noticing things and making connections in my own mind as I read and being like, oh, this is going to come back, or, oh, I bet this is really this. And like, that's part of the pleasure of reading, I think, is like paying attention and kind of, you know, feeling like you're helping to build this thing. So I guess, you know, we got 2 minutes left. What are you working on now? Or what do you, you know, what's next for you?
Yeah, I am working on the adaptation of Interior Chinatown for Hulu. We'll see how that goes. And thinking about, you know, yeah, what I've been writing essays and other short assignments that I really enjoy that keep things fresh. So a lot of that stuff. So yeah. How about you? What are you working on? You have a book coming out. So.
The sequels to Victory is Greater Than Death. And I also have an adult novel that's like a secret that I'm kind of scribbling on in notebooks. So we'll see what happens with that.
Exciting.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And thanks to everybody for showing up tonight. It's such a thrill. And oh, here's Jessica. I was going to say books are available and there's links and things, but Jessica can tell us more.
There are links. And I just wanted to say thanks also, add my thanks to the chorus. Thanks, Charles and Charlie Jane, for an awesome conversation. Luckily, if you missed any of it or if you just want to watch it again, we are going to be posting the recording to YouTube. And you can get your copy of Interior Chinatown and other books by Charles and Charlie Jane in our stores or online at greenlightbookstore.com. So thanks so much again to you guys and have a great night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.